Tonight's Dharma talk, I'm going to admit this, tonight's Dharma talk was inspired by a TV show. So I've been watching, I'm actually not recommending this TV show, but I've been watching this TV show called Silo. It's very intense. So that's why I'm not necessarily recommending it. It's very intense. But this week I was watching it one night and I was like, it's so intense. It's like, how are these characters managing? Like, as if they're real people, like they were in my mind, because I'm watching them. But like, how are they managing? Like, it's so stressful. And like, how do they figure out what to do or how to be? Like, how do they make any decisions, and how do they frame their life? And then I realized, like, wait a second, like, this is us, right? In our lives, it can be very confusing. It can be like choppy seas. We don't know what to do. How do we frame things? And so this Dharma talk arose out of that. How do we make sense of the stress and the challenges in our life? So in fact, the Buddhist path is an actual path that we can follow, that many people for thousands of years have been following. People just like you, right, with stressful lives, have been following. So the Buddhist path, it provides a lens through which to understand our experience, to make sense of the hardships, to provide a path towards wisdom and compassion. This Buddhist path, these Buddhist teachings, these Buddhist practices in particular, are a powerful foundation from which to build a life. So I was teaching, I do an in-person, I live north of the Bay Area in Fort Bragg on the coast, and I have a little teeny community, an in-person sangha. And I was talking to this group on Friday and asking, why do you come to this class? Why do you practice meditation? And this one woman said, she was like, well, if I don't meditate every day, I feel really wobbly. Just wobbly was the word that she used. And then this, someone else was talking about the power of mindfulness. And he was saying how when he's practicing awareness, it helps him kind of keep track and know what's going on. So he gave the example of he's retired and he's in his wood shop. And if he doesn't have a little bit of mindfulness, the next thing he knows, like, he's just like on to the next project, on to the next thing, or he sees something, he goes over there. And the awareness, the practice of awareness, the practice of mindfulness helps him stay steady in what he wants to do. I mean, isn't that true? I wonder if that's why you come to this group, right? Like, the path provides a foundation from which to live life. It helps us understand how to make decisions, or at least figure out what's important to us, to make our decisions based on how to act. It helps us start to understand for ourselves what choices are harmful for ourselves and harmful for other people, and conversely, what choices might be less harmful for ourselves and others. Through this framing of a personal life, we can begin to trust our own capacity. We can begin to trust our own capacities to see through the delusion or the misunderstanding that we're separate from the wholeness of everything else, from the wholeness of the universe, that we're held, that we belong, that we're not separate. But we can get so lost and feel isolated and forget. And that's why we have these practices. That's why we have the path. That's why we have this community that you can come to and sit with together. So we begin to make choices that go against the forces, and they can be quite strong forces, right? The forces of craving, the forces of greed, the forces of aversion and hatred. And so we can begin to make choice to have some freedom in our lives, to begin to make choice and develop a confidence and trust in our own capacity to meet each moment fully with awareness and love. We have so many decisions every day, all day, right? What to eat, what to wear, what to tune into, what TV show to watch. It actually, like, I've noticed for myself, the watching of the intense TV show, I can feel it in my mind and heart, the echoes of it the next morning, right? Like we can, as we begin to practice regularly, we can see how our choices impact our heart and mind. And then we can begin to make choices to move towards that which is the world that we want to live in, right? Like that sense of be the peace, be the change that you want to be, or the way to peace. I'm like quoting Gandhi now, I think randomly, right and left. Be the change that you want to be, and the way to peace is peace. So, but conversely, so often our habits, so often our choices come from habit and come from sort of mainstream or convention. Often all day long, we might be pinging in reaction to pleasant or unpleasant, or the in-between, not really pleasant and not really unpleasant. Some of you might be familiar with this. It's one of the foundations of mindfulness, that in our mindfulness practice, we're asked to start noticing when something's pleasant and noticing when something's unpleasant and noticing when something's in between. So every moment of contact with a sense, whether it's taste or sound or sight or touch or thoughts, even every moment of contact has this quality. It comes with a quality, or it might be pleasant, it might be unpleasant, or it might be somewhere in between, not really one or the other. And if we don't have a little bit of mindfulness, a little bit of awareness, we can spend a lot of time in our life just reacting to this all day long. We think that we're rational, but often our rational mind comes in later and makes a story to justify the choice that we've made. So choices sometimes are made out of reactivity. They can be made out of habit. Our choices can be made out of cultural conditioning. You grew up that way. So many different factors play into the choices that we make. So from Anallio, who's a really scholarly monk, he's a German man who's a monk, he wrote, sustained contemplation will reveal the fact that feeling. So he's using the word feelings, which is, he's referring to Vedana, which is what I'm referring to when I say pleasant, unpleasant, or neither one of those. So the Vedana, the feeling, or the Vedana, but it's not a feeling like an emotion. It's the Vedana, the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Okay, so he says, sustained contemplation will reveal the fact that Vedana does decisively influence and color subsequent thoughts and reactions. In view of this conditioning role of Vedana, the supposed supremacy of rational thought over feelings and emotions turns out to be an illusion. Isn't that true? Sometimes, like, our mind will tell a story after, and we're, yeah, so many things can impact when we're making decisions or choices or how we're living our life. The path of the Buddha, quite literally the Eightfold Path, it gives us instructions and direction for how to move through the world, how to begin to have real choice rather than reactivity. I always think of the Eightfold Path as like the yellow brick road in the Wizard of Oz, and we could sing a song together about it. We're going to follow the yellow brick road, right? And we're going to, in the end, be not where we left, which is at home in our own heart. Like, we haven't actually left anywhere, but we have had this whole adventure along the way. We're going to follow the Eightfold Path, the yellow brick road of the Eightfold Path. And in particular, actually, in this Eightfold Path, importance is mindfulness. This mindfulness is awareness that allows us to see clearly and begin to make choices, to make decisions rather from habit and reactivity, but actually towards the development of wisdom and compassion. So mindfulness, which is one of these eight path factors, one of these eight practices that can support us towards the cultivation of harmlessness, mindfulness, this practice, it allows us to see clearly without judgment where we are in our heart and minds. We need to know where we are to get to where we want to go. We might have this aspiration, a beautiful aspiration. I asked you at the beginning of the meditation, like, what is your intention? What is your aspiration for your meditation practice? We might have really beautiful aspirations. But just like on the phone GPS, needs to know where I am to get me the instructions to go where I might want to go. And in the same way, we need to know where we are to get to where we want to go. And the eightfold path, the Buddhist teachings, the Buddhist practices, this path allows us to explore and investigate where we're going and where we are, so that we can see what needs to be done. So mindfulness allows us to see clearly without judgment where we are in our heart and mind right now, right in this very moment. And then from the third Zen patriarch, when love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Isn't that a description of awareness, of mindfulness? When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. So we have this eightfold path. This path can be more aptly described as components rather than steps. So sometimes it might be like a step, each one is a step, but it's also each one is a component that it's comparable to the intertwining of strands of a single cable or rope that requires the contribution of each of the different eightfold path factors to get maximum strength of that cable. It's like, it's a funny metaphor. It's like that each of the eight path factors is wound together to make a single rope, and then we can swing through the jungle like Tarzan and Jane to freedom and awakening. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit right now about each of the eight. And to be clear, I know many of you have studied these eight a lot, and I know for a fact that each one of the eight could have its own series of Dharma talks, but I just want to go over them because maybe some of you are newer, and then plus Dharma is good in the beginning, the middle, and the end, and we need reminding to keep it in the forefront of our minds, right? To keep the practices and the path in the forefront of our minds. So the first one is wise view. This is that our actions have consequence. You know this, right? What's that bumper sticker? Practice random acts of kindness. Like, we know how powerful random acts of kindness can be. We also know how powerful a hurtful word can be, or some small action that somebody does. So our actions have consequences. Right view, our wise view, is our understanding of the Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering, that is part of being a human being. There is that which is hard to bear. We could also talk about the fact that to be human is to have vulnerabilities, right? This is part of wise view, that there is a cause to our stress, there's a cause to our suffering, there's an end to our suffering, and that there's a path. So the wise view starts with the path. It starts with our understanding of why we would want to practice. It starts with our actions having consequence. Okay, that's wise view, which is just moving along. The second one, and remember, these path factors are a frame or a foundation from which to live life, from which to make choices, to make decisions, to help us understand what we're doing and why we're doing it. So the second one is wise intention. This concept aims at our intentions of either peaceful renunciation, you know, that thing where you let go and it starts to feel a lot better. Has this happened to you? Or it's maybe even a little incorrect to frame it as something that we do. Sometimes the letting go happens to us. I don't know, has it ever happened to you where something was really bothering you, and it was a lot of suffering, and then for some reason it let go, and there was so much spaciousness then, a sense of ease, right? Like that letting go when it happens to us. This is wise intention when we come into the resolve or the intention to let go. So wise intention has three different categories, three different lists within this list of eight. And the first one is wise renunciation or peaceful renunciation. The second one is the cultivation, the deliberate and intentional, right? Because we're in the category of intention. So the intentional cultivation of renunciation, the intentional cultivation of non-ill will, or I could say in the positive, the intentional cultivation of goodwill, of loving kindness. Metta is the word, which I'm sure many of you have heard. So the intentional cultivation of goodwill, the intentional cultivation of harmlessness, compassion, or the intentional moving away from cruelty. Okay, so the three. The first is peaceful renunciation, intentionally cultivating in our life. The second is intentional goodwill. The third is intentional non-harming or harmlessness. So this is wise intention. The third one of the Eightfold Path is wise speech. You know, how we are with each other is so important. We might have this beautiful aspiration, this beautiful intention of non-ill will, this beautiful intention of harmlessness. And how do we put that into action? How do you actually do that? I mean, it sounds really beautiful, but how do we actually do that? We do that with our speech, yes? How we speak to each other is so important. So this category or this path factor involves abstaining from false speech. So don't lie, no lying. Abstaining from slanderous speech. So slanderous speech, for some, maybe that makes a lot of sense to you, but for me, a way to frame the slanderous speech is divisive speech. So in my family growing up, there was a way my family bonded was to kind of cut down people who were not in the family unit. Like we would, right? Like it was kind of like creating this category, this divisive speech between us and those people over there. So that would be in this category of slanderous speech or divisive speech that we want to avoid because it actually leads us to feeling isolated and disconnected. So abstaining from slanderous speech, abstaining from harsh speech, idle chatter. You know what I love about idle chatter? If I bring mindfulness to my idle chatter, it's not idle chatter anymore. Isn't that beautiful? Like sometimes I might want to like just have a little like chitty chat about the weather, but if I'm doing it intentionally with mindfulness, remember I said mindfulness is in some ways is the crux of what we're doing. We need to have awareness. We bring a little mindfulness into our speech. It's no longer idle chatter. Okay, so that's the third path factor. The fourth one, remember, these are all ways to frame our life. They're instructions to help us have an understanding of how to meet the challenges. The fourth one is wise action. So we're instructed to not kill, to not injure, to not take what is not given. So no stealing. and no sexual misconduct, right? So it's like a gift. It's like a generous gift of safety to the people around us, to our communities. If we're not stealing, if we're not killing, if we're not being sexually inappropriate. The fifth one is wise livelihood. So how we spend our life force. To be avoided is dealing in weapons, in living and in dealing in weapons or living beings. To avoid working in meat production, in butchery, in poisons, and in intoxicants. The Buddha further names several dishonest means of gaining wealth, which fall under this category of wrong livelihood, which would be practicing deceit, treachery, soothsaying, trickery, and usury. So wise livelihood. Just how we're spending our life force. And maybe you're retired, so you might think it doesn't quite apply to you, but really, how are you spending your life force? What are you doing with this one, as Mary Oliver says, this one wild and precious life? So those path factors, the first five, are really applicable, I think, to daily life. The next three are considered to be meditation practices, but I also feel like they can be really helpful guidance for daily life too. So number six is wise effort, which is the preventing of the arising of unwholesome mind states. Does that make sense? So as best you can, like for me, if I skip a meal, I'm going to get really irritable. That's going to be an unwholesome mind state. So I would avoid skipping a meal to prevent the arising of the unwholesome mind state. I hope that makes sense. So preventing the arising of the unwholesome mind state, if an unwholesome mind state has arisen. So say there's like, oh, this happened to me the other day in my meditation. I like was sitting there and I had just such like longing, I would even use the word craving for peacefulness. It was just like, I just wish all the shenanigans would stop. And if I could just have one moment of peace, if I could just get some peace, right? This kind of craving for something that actually wasn't in the moment. And I saw, so there was mindfulness because I was practicing meditation. And through grace, it was a moment of mindfulness. I could see, oh, craving is here. This is craving, because it was like this tension in my body, this craving for something that I thought was outside of myself in the future. If I could just get there, right? So this is wise effort, using mindfulness to just see, oh, craving is here. I didn't have to judge it. I didn't have to try and push it away. I could just see it and hold it in some kindness. And you know what happened? It changed, because everything always changes. So this is wise effort. If there's an unwholesome mind state, we might use mindfulness to help it dissipate. Also included in wise effort is, let's see, there's four of them. Oh, I'm going to need your help. See, there's four. So, okay, here we go. Preventing an unwholesome from arising. If an unwholesome has arisen, doing what I can to help it chew out the door. Oh, and then the wholesome are the beautiful mind states. What are the beautiful mind states? The beautiful mind states are like generosity, our gratitude, our mindfulness, our equanimity. So many beautiful mind states. So creating the conditions. I always like to think of this as like, I'm a gardener. I always like to think of this as like, I'm gardening the wholesome states. So create the conditions for the wholesome states to arise. So in my garden, to make sure the tomatoes are nice, I have to make sure the tomatoes have the proper amount of sunlight and water and the right kind of soil so that the tomato will make a beautiful, yummy tomato. And in the same way with wise effort, it's like we're gardening ourselves or creating the conditions for those wholesome states to come, which includes listening to a Dharma talk or doing a meditation or, you know, all the things that you know Okay, let's see. Oh, and then the fourth one is like, if there's a wholesome mind state here, maybe using a little mindfulness or doing what you can to keep it going a little longer. Okay, so that's wise effort. And then we have wise mindfulness is path factor number 7. Wise mindfulness. Mindfulness is a quality that guards or watches over the mind and heart, right? It helps us. It's like a true friend. It's not a true friend that's slightly judgmental on the edges. It's not that kind of friend. It's mindfulness is a true friend that really, really has our best interest at heart. It's a quality that guards or watches over the heart and mind. And then the eighth path factor is wise samadhi, or wise focusing of the mind, so that we're developing the skill of focusing the mind. The mind actually can be developed. We can cultivate a kind of focus with our meditation practice, in the same way as if you went to the gym and started lifting weights and you got make some biceps going. In the same way with our mindfulness practice, with our meditation practice, we can cultivate a focus or samadhi or steadiness in the heart and mind. Okay, so from Pema Chodron, she said, and she wrote, "Everything changes when you start to emit your own frequency, rather than absorbing the frequencies around you. When you start imprinting your intent on the universe rather than receiving an imprint from existence," right? Everything changes. Everything changes when you start to emit your own frequency, when you start to engage upon or engage with these practices and these teachings, everything will change. You become your own authority in some way. Or another way to say that actually would be, you start to have more and more agency, more and more opportunity to make choices that are moving towards the wholesome, that are moving towards harmlessness, that are moving towards wisdom and clarity. You become your own authority, with your own agency. So to bring in a little nuance here, you know, we're given the Eightfold Path and we begin to walk this path. We begin to weave these different strands, these eight strands into our lives. And we have to walk the path ourselves. No one else can do it for you. Famously, the Buddha would not tell people what to do. Even when people came to him and asked if they should go to war or they should not go to war, he wouldn't say, "Oh, you should definitely not go to war," like if a king came to him. He would give information. He would give information, and the decision would be up to the person, or the decision would be up to you. So in some ways, this might sound like really concrete, right? These eightfold, and they are in some ways concrete, but when we start to actually work with these eight different practices, we can start to see how nuanced and complex it gets. And that we begin through our practice to have more and more of our own knowing of these instructions, these practices. The onus of decision squarely rests with yourself as you practice. The Buddha clarifies that you are individually responsible for your own decisions. So I have a very famous sutta called the Kalama Sutta. It's in the Anguttara Nikaya. Now, this translation, for those of you that have studied this, it's not exact. This is actually a translation that James Baraz gave in a Dharma talk. So this is a translation that he got, anyway, that I got. So this is a looser translation, but just to hear the nuance the Buddha is talking about. So he was talking to the Kalamas, which was a group of people. And he said that the Kalamas must decide what is true, not so to decide what is true, not by what you have heard, not by what you, not by following convention, not by assumption. So you're deciding what is true, not by what you have heard, not by following convention, not by assumption, not by relying on text, not because of reasoning or logic, not by thinking about explanations, not by acquiescing to the views you prefer, and not out of respect for a teacher, but when you know for yourself. Isn't that beautiful? So all the things, the outside things, teachers, what's written in a book, our views that we were raised with, not even by our logical minds, not by rationality, but really by when you know for yourself, when you have an understanding based on the practices. So maybe tonight was your first meditation ever, but you learned something tonight and it wasn't something you read in a book or something I told you. You maybe learned that your mind is very busy. That might have been the first insight. That might have been the last insight, right? But you knew it for yourself. So the Buddha's pointing us towards us engaging with these practices. And by engaging with the practices, only by engaging with the practices, will you have your own understanding. Only by engaging with the practices will you have a way to actually to help you, right, this process to help you navigate through the craziness that is life, the intensity that is life. So we're asked to turn towards our own practice and our own knowing. You know, sometimes we might try and get the right answer to know what to happen. Maybe you have a decision that you have to make in your life right now, or something's up and you're trying to get the right answer, trying to figure out the right way. Like, what is the right way? What should I do? What's the right way? And then the mind, as soon as we start to do that, the mind becomes contracted. And in that contraction, it's very difficult for the wisdom of your own heart to come through. So sometimes when I have a hard time with a decision, sometimes I'll have a hard time with a decision and I'll be like, oh, should I do that or should I do that? And I don't know. And usually when that indecision comes for me, I realize everybody's different, but often that indecision will come when there's a kind of fixation on an outcome. We can't know the outcome, can we? We can't know. We can use our mindfulness. We can use our mindfulness. We can use our intention, our aspiration, our wise view to help us begin to move forward and navigate through. Instead of trying to get the right answer, we can always come back to what is this moment? What is true in this moment? The mind can often become contracted in fear and worry. I don't know if you experienced that. Have you experienced that in the last 10 minutes? The mind can become contracted in fear and worry. But in fact, we don't have to. And in fact, we can't figure out outcomes. We don't have to figure anything out. We can, however, know the present moment with our mindfulness practice, with our seeing clearly without judgment, that we can know what's true in this moment. And that is actually enough, because that's the only place that we can move from. The more you talk about something and think it through often, the further astray you wander from the truth. So another quote from the third Zen patriarch, stop talking and thinking, and there is nothing you will not be able to know. Isn't that a beautiful paradox? I love that. I'm going to say it again because I think it's so awesome. Stop talking and thinking, and there is nothing you will not be able to know. So the invitation is to explore with curiosity rather than trying to get the right answer. And when we do that, we are more able to access our own inner wisdom to meet the moment, as a friend. The quest for certainty is a fool's errand. So while the Eightfold Path might sound really concrete, and in some ways it's very concrete instructions, but we are asked to walk the path and engage with the instructions and see what we know in our own hearts. Can we learn to trust ourselves? Can we learn to trust the present moment? And then one more, Pema Chodron. In any encounter, we have a choice. We can strengthen our resentment, or we can strengthen our understanding and empathy. We have the choice. We can widen the gap between ourselves and others, or we can lessen it. So the Buddha Dharma provides us with a framework through which to understand experience. The Buddha Dharma provides a framework for us to make sense of our hardships. It provides a path towards wisdom and compassion. The Buddha Dharma is a powerful foundation from which to build your life. All right, my friends, that's what I have for you tonight. And then we have maybe like 5 minutes if there's any comments or questions or anything that you wanted to share. I'd love to hear from you all. And if there's not, of course, there's not. But comments or questions, and I can't see, I'm on a small device, so I can't see everybody, but if you wanted to unmute yourself, you could say something. And if there's nothing to be said, that's fine too. We'll just see what arises. Let's see, Mary Kelly, please.
So thank you. I mean, this was lovely, and it's not like, you know, I've never heard of the Eightfold Path or thought about it or anything, but it's the Dharma is good in the beginning, in the middle, and the end. And this was a very nice reminder. And one of the things I've been doing lately is in the beginning, and it's night, my beginning, my meditation. One of the things I look at, even before you mentioned it, is I'm looking at, you know, wise view. And then I think of like wholesome intention. And what I realized, especially for myself, is that, I mean, all kind of this little the basket that kind of holds your life. But for me, one of the things I realized is that, you know, over the decades, I've realized that some of the views I've had, are like even the things that are in front of me, are just, you know, I'm not seeing them clearly. I'm seeing them through whatever my biases are, whatever my experiences are, and, you know, whatever my perceptions are. And it's just really helpful to just be sometimes as bare as I can be with my, like, with my sitting experience. Like, how am I actually feeling? What do I feel like? And I just think that, you know, coming back to these practices and looking at them in a way that they are so basic, but they really aren't. I mean, it's just like, I mean, the nuances of wise speech, all of them, they just are so important. And for me, one of the things I've realized now too is I pair the parami of patience with wise view, because I realize I really need to be patient with myself, because sometimes I just I need to take the time to not just jump into something and just, you know, what's really happening now? And then, you know, I mean, years ago, I found out that, you know, my anger was just sitting on top of a great deal of sadness. You know, and just being with what's there and really being able to see it is so helpful. And you know, this is the longer I practice, the more I realize that, you know, this is just crap I don't know yet. And that's okay too. That's okay too. You know, it's just like a little bit of kindness and compassion. So thank you for this reminder. It's really nice. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mary. I just want to highlight thing you said at the beginning. You said that you don't even know, sometimes like we don't even see our unconscious bias. And I think there's been, or like our biases, and they're unconscious to us. And I think there's actually been a lot of research that shows that mindfulness actually helps with biases around race and class and gender. And because we start with our practice, slowly, slowly start to see all the things that were invisible to us, right? So, anyway, I could keep going, but let's see if there's anybody else, because I want to hear from you all. You already heard from me a lot. I want to hear from you. Yeah, Deborah, please. Oh, you're muted. You're muted, dear. You'll have to unmute yourself.
Sorry. So to keep this very short, I had a Dharma teacher for a very long time who lives in another state and went into semi-retirement and then into retirement and really stopped teaching. And this man really helped change my life. And I met him in 1995. And we've stayed in touch over the years. And not too long ago, he wrote and told me he had 1 to 4 years to live. And I thought, okay, I got my fingers crossed for the four. And yesterday, I got an email from him telling me that it would be the last email I would get from him. He's basically going on hospice and he can't take care of his life anymore, and to please feel free to write him one more email for closure. Knowing that this would be the last time I would be communicating with him personally, that it would all be on Caring Bridge. You know, I'm sure everybody's heard of Caring Bridge. He told me months ago that he was ready. He's been living with this lung thing for many years, and I guess I was in a little bit of denial. So writing this email, starting last night and deep into the night, and then again today and again today, and I called an old Dharma friend in Utah and talked to her about it. And some of the things that you said tonight, the way you phrased the talk, what you said about Vedana, that it's not the emotion, it's the, is it pleasant, unpleasant, or, so it was really hard. And I noticed that I did not want to stop writing this email. I kept editing it and it's too long and it, over and up, because I knew that once I sent this email, that would be it. My communications with him would, that, you know, from here on will be through Caring Bridge. And it's really, really hard. And one of the things I kept coming back to is, what's my intention here? You know, is this about me? Or is it about him? You know, is it about my sadness or my frustration or my loss? Or is this about him and thanking him for the gift he's been in my life for 25 years or something, 20 years, whatever. So when you talk tonight about intention and the Vedana, and it was just so resonant with what I was doing last night and a lot of today, saying what I wanted to say, but keeping in mind who I was talking to and what my intentions were. You know, that I, you know, it's not about me. Yeah. So anyway, as always, wow. You knock it out of the park every time, Ashley. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. Thank you. I'm sorry to hear about your friend and teacher. That's hard. And I love, actually, your story is exactly what I'm saying. Like, these practices give us a frame to help us navigate through the hard situations. So just, that's beautiful. It's a beautiful example.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I think just to honor our time, even though I really, is there anybody who's got a burning thing, or if there's anything that needs to be said, there's a moment. Yeah. Okay. Let's hear those metas. I love to hear those. I think Sherry's going to read them.